Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What will happen as global CO2 levels continue to rise? Well, along with rising sea levels, ecosystem changes, species unable to adapt to warmer temperatures and higher CO2 levels, will we also see a big jump in plant growth and food production from those longer growing seasons and higher CO2 concentrations? Well, the answers are simultaneously yes and no. My guest today is a part of a group of researchers attempting to answer those questions. They found that most food stock plants will see more robust growth, but that won't necessarily translate to mean more food production from the plant. And in fact, they'll have increased competition from weeds and non-cultivated species. Louis Ziska is a research plant physiologist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in their Agricultural Research Service. His research is specialized on rice species as well as some of our most noxious weed species like ragweed and poison ivy. Perhaps some of the worst news from his research is that those two species will easily adapt to more CO2 in the environment and will actually thrive in that environment. In addition to his work at the Department of Agriculture, Ziska has contributed to the food security section of the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, report. He'll be giving the 5th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Biology this evening at 7 o'clock at the University of Tulsa's Helmrich Hall, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Louis Ziska, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of your work has been looking at the effect of increased CO2 levels associated with climate change on a lot of our plant species, not only our food stock plants, but also weeds. And in fact, you're kind of the expert on what weeds and invasive species do with increased CO2 levels. What's the preliminary research show at this point?
Well, there's sort of a good news, bad news scenario. And since everyone always asks me to give the bad news first, I'll mention that. When you start looking at weeds, the common definition of are plants that are widely spread, that produce a lot of different seeds, genetically diverse, and as it turns out, they're also well adapted to change. So when you have the climate changing, when you have extremes events occurring, what that does is essentially select for a lot of these particular invasives or particular known agronomic weeds. They do a lot better with more CO2. They do. They tend to distribute themselves a little more easily when you have extreme events occurring. So they're very well suited to that kind of environment that we're seeing now and we expect to see in the next decades. The good news scenario from a food perspective is that some of those weeds, at least, are related to many of the crop plants that we are currently growing. For example, I do a lot of work with rice in Arkansas and in eastern Texas. And wild rice or weedy rice is a huge problem. Well, it turns out that weedy rice is very well adapted to some of these climate extremes that we are beginning to see, and it's also better able to take some of that carbon dioxide and convert that into seed yield. So in many ways, it's sort of a template of how we can improve existing rice lines by making them more like their weedy cousins. And we hope that by doing that, we can begin to essentially adapt to or take advantage of some of the changes in CO2 and climate that we're seeing.
Now, just take rice, for example.
Sure.
I've seen there's a good news, bad news side to that, too, which is that while you're weedier, the wild rice varieties will probably do better with increased CO2 levels. There's a possibility of the dilution of these highly defined rice rolls that we use for food production, and I'm not sure exactly what the right term is, but we're likely to see a dilution of those strains that we've developed over years to maximize food production.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let me kind of back up a step here and sort of give you the 50-cent tour of climate change, if you will. There are a couple of things that are going on. One is obviously that as the climate warms, it's warming differentially. Some areas are warming faster than others. That's going to produce extreme events, yada, yada. The other issue that doesn't get a lot of attention is the fact that as CO2 rises, CO2 is actually a resource for plants, and it makes plants grow more.
It's respiration.
You can look at it as a benefit, if you will. So plants need water, they need light, they need nutrients, they need carbon dioxide. So that sounds really great, except that not all plants, when you give them CO2, respond the same way. So in the case of rice, the weedy rice or the wild rice, and we're not talking, you know, Harry and David's wild, you know, that kind of rice.
You're talking real skanky rice.
Exactly. Skanky rice that no farmer wants to see in their field. And what we're seeing is that as CO2 rises, that in fact is being selected for. It's better able to respond to that as opposed to the sort of domesticated or cultivated rice that we traditionally grow. And so you're kind of faced with a dilemma. You're seeing on one hand the skanky rice, if you will, that's doing really well, and then the traditional rice, which isn't doing quite so well in terms of adapting to climate change. So the question now becomes, well, what parts of that genetics of the skanky rice can we then begin to incorporate to breed for and select for and adapt to those changes in climate, which this rice, this weedy rice, is already doing? As part of that, what we see happening is that, if you'll pardon the expression, as the weedy rice is feeling its oats, and there's several mixed metaphors in there, I'm sure, it's better able to proliferate, to send its pollen over to the cultivated rice and begin to take over the genome of the cultivated rice. And that's, of course, one of the things that farmers are concerned about, is that you spend a lot of money, and industry spends a lot of money to make sure that rice is uniform, that it all flowers at the same time, it gives you exactly the quality of rice that you deserve, so forth. So that's one of the major challenges, is how do we begin to look at that degree of interbreeding between those two different, very different rice lines, and at the same time begin to look at the adaptive characteristics of the skanky rice to begin to carry those characteristics over through traditional breeding to the cultivated rice to boost yields on the cultivated rice. And we talk about rice for a reason, and it isn't just because it's, you know, good to have with red beans. We talk about rice because globally it's the major cereal that 2 billion people in the world depend on as a primary food source. It's hugely important. And believe it or not, even though we don't consume a lot of rice in the United States, we export a lot of rice. We're in the top 5 exporters globally. So what happens to climate change and CO2 and how the rice genome is affected by that is going to have huge implications with respect to not only what happens here, but obviously what happens globally.
Let me get back to the competition question between sort of the wild rice and the domesticated rice. Even if you start creating hybrids that incorporate some of those qualities that seem to adapt well to climate change and rising CO2 levels, does the fact that competition is increasing because of the wild rice's ability to adapt easier cause more problems in those cultivars because you're sort of unintentionally adding more effects of those wild rice species to your cultivated versions?
Basically, what you're asking is that if I change a resource in the environment and the wild rice, the skanky rice, and the cultivated rice react differently, what that's going to do is put additional pressure on the cultivated rice. And the short answer is yes, it does. Mm. And it's important to consider that while that doesn't sound like a lot, in fact, weeds are the major constraint for rice production, well, for all major cereal production globally. You got your summers off as a kid for school, right? Everybody did. Why? Well, because way back when you had to go work on the farm. Why? What did you do as a kid on the farm?
You weeded.
You weeded, exactly. Weeds were, in fact, the one activity that everybody did from the time they could handle the business end of a hoe until the time they graduated from high school. In fact, many farms before mechanization were determined, the size of the farm was determined by how much you could weed. So weeds are a huge issue, and we sometimes forget that because we're at the age where, you know, you spray X, Y, and Z, and it's taken care of, and you don't worry about it. But that threat has never really gone away. And what's happening with respect to climate and CO2 is that we see these weedy, skanky lines that are very able to take advantage of this, increasing pressure in terms of cultivation. And like I said, the bad news is that's going to have adverse effects. The good news is, how can we take what these guys are doing in terms of their adaptation and convey some of that those genetics over into cultivated lines to boost production and maintain food security?
Now, rice is a somewhat unusual case because you have these wild varieties growing oftentimes in competition with the cultivated kinds. when you look at other food crops, it's just straight weeds. And one of the central tenets of what I'm seeing from the research, the agricultural research service has been doing, is that increased CO2 levels is just a boon for weeds of all types.
That is true. And again, this idea that as CO2 rises up, it makes plants grow more, sounds great, and it sounds like it's environmentally friendly, but it isn't necessarily, because depending on what kinds of things are going to grow more, like some of these weeds, the Dalmatian toadflax, knapweed, Canada thistle, and there's a whole litany of them. They're nasty things, and they have an effect not only with respect to ag, but they also have an effect with respect to nature. Oklahoma is home to some of the most beautiful prairie on the planet. And one of the things that we're seeing happening is that as you change the environment, some of those native species are eventually being crowded out. They're not being selected for. What is being selected for are things like knapweed and thistle and a lot of these things, which are, you know, going to have this advantage because they can convert this carbon dioxide more into their growth, into their seed yield, than some of the other more traditional prairie-type grasses. So it's a huge effect. And one of the other things that we're looking at is how are these what have been termed invasive species being impacted by the change in CO2? How are they being impacted by the climate, by temperatures? Many of them are kept in check, for example, by colder winters. One of my favorite ones is kudzu. If you haven't seen kudzu, I don't know if it's gotten to Oklahoma yet.
It could be down in far southeastern Oklahoma,
okay.
but certainly if you go much further south, you're going to start
seeing kudzu. I know you'll run into it in Arkansas, and Lord knows you'll run into it in Mississippi and Alabama. How do I describe kudzu? Think of a really bad 1950s science fiction movie where Little Shop of Horrors meets
the plants are out of control.
They're there. And the joke in the South is that if you leave your dog on the doorstep and kudzu's anywhere around, the dog will be missing in the morning. So it really is. I mean, it's not quite that bad, but you get the idea. It's a vine.
You can go through a woodland area where kudzu is basically not only covering the ground, it's covering the trees, it's covering the branches of the tree. It literally envelops the trees.
It does. I've heard it's a vegetative form of cancer. It's the revenge of the South. There are all kinds of different names for it. But the bottom line is that it is a invasive that essentially destroys ecosystem function. Once it gets in there and it envelops everything, then the system crashes. It's the only thing that will survive. It's the only thing that will proliferate. It's the only thing that's going to determine what up to then have been a functioning, thriving system, but now only consists of one species that essentially becomes dominant. Unfortunately, one of the things that we're seeing is that it's also a really great responder to rising CO2 levels. It's moving north at a ratio of something like 50,000 acres every year. A couple of years ago, it was spotted in Canada for the first time.
Canada?
In Canada.
Like in a very temperate area or
in,
like along the
southern Canada on the northern shore of Lake Erie.
Wow.
Nobody expected it to be there. We knew it was moving north. We just didn't know it was moving north that quickly. And one of the things that is happening is that as these mild winters over the last 20, 30 years have been increasing in their frequency, that sort of cold temperature's not keeping kudzu in check anymore. It's simply marching northward. And it's not the only thing. I mean, there are lots of insects, lots of other nasties that are out there that are having a detrimental effect and how nature works and how it survives. Bark beetle is another.
Yeah, I was going to say a pine bark beetles in Colorado, where you see these whole stands of ponderosa pines just deader than a doornail.
Well, it kind of reached a threshold actually 2 years ago. You know, there's the western forests and the eastern forests, right? And then there's the plains. But if you keep moving northward into Canada, at some point you run into where the forests all connect again. 2 years ago, pine bark beetle jumped. It jumped the Rockies from the western side to the eastern side. And now it just has to move south. And there's nothing standing between it and decimating the eastern forests in the next 20 years.
Now, when you start talking about, you know, the fact that mild winters, we're just coming off a 20 or 30 year harsh winter.
Right.
How much does one winter make a difference in, say, the expansion of kudzu or the pine beetle, I mean, will it knock those levels down? Because as I know about the pine beetle, it's basically mild winters allows more of them to survive the winter, which, again, it's just a numbers question.
Well, there's no question that it knocks it back. But the point, really, you need to have them in sequence. They need to occur not just once, but they need to occur every 3 or 4 years in order to keep the populations in check. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing, in essence, that the trend has been that winters are on the rise, temperatures are on the rise, and as a result of that, we're seeing all these shifts in plant and insect populations, which are going to have a huge issue with respect to both functioning of native systems, but again, also with agriculture.
My guest today is Louis Ziska, a research plant physiologist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service. He contributed to the food security chapter in the most recent IPCC report, and he'll be giving the 5th annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Tulsa's Helmer Hall. Well, let's go to another topic of really good news, and that is for allergy sufferers. This is another area that you work on a lot, and you do a lot of research with ragweed and poison ivy. What have you found when you increase the CO2 levels?
Well, first of all, I found that working with those two species really doesn't endear you with your staff. I have to say that it's not a thing that makes you popular. That being said, they're really fascinating species in their own right. And what we have found is that as you change the environment, again, this idea that weeds, because of their greater genetic diversity, are able to adapt more quickly to the changes in the environment related to climate perturbations is really true. And so we started out in the laboratory with ragweed, and we exposed them to projected changes in CO2 and saw, boy, they just took off. They grew more. They made more pollen. Some indication that the pollen was more allergenic, that it had more of that stuff that makes you sneeze. But it was a lab study, right? So how relevant is that in the real world? So our next step was to say, well, can we increase its relevance? Well, how do you do that? How do you look at the CO2 and or temperature that's going to occur 30 years from now? It's pretty tough to do that, right? Hard to do that in the lab. So we decided we'd actually use urban areas as cities as sort of a surrogate for projecting future climate. So we know the cities, for example, are warmer. They have what's called an urban heat island effect. They have more CO2, about 20-25% more CO2. So we used Baltimore, poor Baltimore, I live there actually, as sort of the guinea pig in this. And we set up the same soil, same seed, same seed bank. We took them out in trucks. They were, 2 meters by 2 meters by a meter deep. So the soil was the same. Set up weather stations, downtown Baltimore and the suburbs of Baltimore, and then out in an organic farm. And what we saw to our both interest in terms of science, but also to our consternation as people, was that the ragweed just went crazy. Basically, it flowered earlier. It produced, I think the average ragweed plant in downtown Baltimore produced about 10 times more pollen than the same plant growing in organic farm in western Maryland. And when you start looking at why, well, the growing season was longer. Fewer frost days, more CO2, more temperature, all of that contributes to the ability of ragweed to grow and pollinate. Okay. Reflect on this for a moment. Well, this is better. You're making it a little more relevant, but you're still kind of regional. How do we think big? How do we do this on a continental level? Well, I needed help at this point because, only so much you can do. So I contacted folks within what's called the National Allergy Bureau. And these are the really dedicated scientists and medical professionals who every day are out there, have the fun task of looking at pollen and counting the pollen and seeing where the pollen's coming from. And I had to sort of cold call them and say, hi, you don't know me, but I'm not crazy, really, I'm not. Can you provide me with some of your data? And surprisingly, they were wonderful. They were just, people like Linda Ford in Nebraska, Estelle Levitin here at University of Tulsa. All these guys were just fantastic. And so what we did is we took their data and we tested the hypothesis, which was, okay, we know that warming is happening not all the same area. We know, for example, that as you move toward the poles, it's warming up faster than at the equator, and I won't go into the physics behind that. But if that's true, then what we should see are changes in ragweed pollen that are greater as you move northward. And our first thought was, well, we ought to be able to look at the numbers of pollen, right? Except we ran into a glitch. The problem was everybody counted pollen differently, and you can't compare the methods.
Oh,
I know.
Unfortunately.
That hurt. But even though they're counted differently, when they start and when they stop are consistent, all right? So we could look at it from the point of view of season length, the time that you're exposed to ragweed pollen. Okay. When we did this, going back 20 years, what we found was that in the southern part of the U.S., Texas, Oklahoma, not much change. When you got to Canada, 4 weeks longer pollen season since the 1990s.
Wow.
So definitely now we were getting some satisfaction out of this, that we were able to take it from the lab to the region, to the continental level, and to show that really this is having an impact in real time. So this is really, I know this sounds a little unusual because, hey, I'm working with weeds, but it's really fun. And
yeah,
it's really, it's so fascinating and so exciting to be able to show this is happening in real time and to show that it has relevance and to sort of illustrate what the consequences are for the population as a whole.
Now, your other study was looking at poison ivy, and you found in fact that it will also thrive with higher CO2 levels, and it becomes more toxic.
Exactly. And this was work done.
You're talking about basically a greater concentration of the substance that we tend to be allergic to.
Right. That substance is called urushiol, which is the oil in poison ivy that causes your skin to break out when it comes in contact with it. And interestingly enough, there are actually samples taken by the Japanese from 1,000 years ago. And they're in pressed sheets. And if you're really sensitive to it, you can actually touch them and still get a reaction. That's how long that oil stays in the environment. Yeah,
no, wow.
It's pretty scary. So we're working with Jackie Moen at the University of Georgia. And again, this idea that CO2 makes plants grow more. And that sounds great. Does it make them all grow the same? No. So we started out at the Duke University CO2 site. Now, imagine, if you will, you're standing in a forest, and around the forest are these tall 50-foot metal standpipes, and there's a hissing coming out from these metal standpipes. And what that hissing is CO2 being injected into the forest. They used 1 million pounds of CO2 every day in order to keep the CO2 in this forest at a level that we anticipate 50 years from now, right? So a major, massive project. And the idea at the beginning was, well, how much more of the CO2 can pine trees sequester? Because, you know, plants use, as we've said now many times, they use CO2 as
and
part
I
of their growth.
And I think some people have said we just should plant more trees as a way
plant
of
more trees
to
and
absorb
and as a
CO2.
Way of absorbing CO2. So that's really what the focus was. Except, again, you know, sort of you take a little crazy turn along the way. And now while the trees are growing more with CO2, it turns out that in the forest understory, unbeknownst to anyone, creeping along literally, was poison ivy. And it turns out that that's the thing that took the CO2 and went crazy. It shows threefold times more growth than the pine trees did. Not only did it grow more, but it was actually producing a more virulent form of the oil, so that less of that oil is needed in order to produce that same degree of toxicity, what's called contact dermatitis on your skin. So, again, this is sort of, you know, you don't expect this to happen. You're looking at one species, another species raises its head and says, hey, look at me. Mm. And, you know, the results, again, are really fascinating.
What about the other major food stocks, soybeans, corn, wheat, barley? Are there any particular findings that we should be concerned about with increased CO2 levels?
I think one of the things we're looking at from a sort of on a large scale is we know that, as we've said, CO2 causes plants to grow. Okay. Is the variety of barley, is the variety of wheat, is the variety of soybean that I'm currently using the best variety that's going to take that carbon dioxide and make more seed? And in every case we've looked at, the answer has been no.
In fact, I think if I read this correctly, there was some research on corn. Mm-hmm. And what they found that the plant actually did thrive with increased CO2, but it was just making leaves, not fruit, if you will, or corn.
I haven't seen that for corn, so okay. I don't want to comment on it. Yeah. But what we have seen for many of these is that, in fact, exactly what you're saying is that vegetatively they would produce more, but not necessarily more in terms of yield or seed. What we're trying to do now is to find those lines, those varieties, and there are thousands of varieties of wheat, there are thousands of varieties of corn, there are thousands of varieties of rice, to find those varieties that can best suit it to take that additional carbon dioxide, and it's gone up by 25% in my lifetime, almost 30% in my lifetime, to take those lines and begin to convert that additional CO2 into more seed yield to feed a hungry world. That's one of the things that we're focusing on right now. It's a slow process. Traditional breeders don't really know how to do this, and you understand why. But we're slowly beginning to initiate this. There are groups that are working with me in Japan and Australia. I would say working with me, but they're doing this, and we're consulting each other. And, you know, they are making some inroads in this. And one of the things that's interesting, and this is a preliminary finding, is that many of the older lines, the lines that were first released back as part of the Green Revolution in the 1960s, may be our best hope for beginning to convert some of that CO2 into additional seed yield. And there are different reasons for that, but we want to try and think of it this way. We know that plants need water and fertilizer and light and CO2. If hypothetically, the amount of fertilizer, the amount, say, of nitrogen had gone up by 25% in the last 40 years. Would you want to breed for that? Would you want to select for lines that would take advantage of that? Of course, the answer would be yes. Well, here it is. The CO2 has gone up by 30% in the last 40 years. Why isn't anybody selecting for it? Why isn't there a sort of a national program to begin to breed for lines that can convert more of the CO2 into seed yield?
You may not be able to answer this question as a government employee, but do you think is it just because of the unsettled politics concerning climate change?
I can give you my own personal opinion. How's that?
Okay.
My personal opinion on this is yes. It's become such a polemic. It's become this good versus bad type philosophy that there doesn't seem to be any room in the middle, and that's unfortunate. If you look at the science of it, you understand why there are concerns. And I'm not saying they're not. There are definitely concerns, and we've talked about some of them. But I'm also saying that whenever something changes, it may provide you an opportunity. The old Chinese saying of, you know, crisis and opportunity. There may be an opportunity here to begin to adapt lines to make them stronger, to make them more resilient, to make them more sustainable. And I think that part of that is going to involve looking more at sort of the wild ancestors of these crops and being able to glean some of those genes, some of those characteristics into our way we currently do ag. And I think if we can do that, and not just do it for ag, but do it for some of the native species, native grass species as well, I think we can come out of this okay. But it's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of change in our mindset and how we currently view rising CO2 and climate change.
Hmm. Well, we wish you great success with your work at the Agricultural Research Service. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.
Dr. Louis Ziska is a research plant physiologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service. He also contributed to the food security section of the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. He'll be giving the 5th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Biology tonight at 7 the University of Tulsa's Helmer Hall. That lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.